Tonight, I'm happy to officially close the season with Lauren Woods, an accomplished conceptual artist in both the public and institutional realm, who is an active, noteworthy participant in our very own community, living and working in Dallas. I appreciate Lauren agreeing to take time out of her very busy schedule to prepare tonight's presentation, and I appreciate you for being here for your personal benefit, of course, but also for many of you, I think, to show support of one of our own. So I appreciate that. Lauren was born in Kansas City, Missouri, but was raised in Texas. She attained a BA in radio, television, and film, as well as a BA in Spanish with a minor in sociology from the University of North Texas, before receiving an MFA from the San Francisco Art Institute in 2006. Her work has been exhibited throughout the United States and internationally, including Washington, D.C., San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York, Dallas, Miami, as well as Puerto Rico, Taiwan, South Korea, Japan, Mali, and France. She has been the recipient of grants and awards from numerous institutions, including Creative Capital Foundation, the Tribeca Film Foundation, College Art Institute, Alliance for Artist Communities, and the San Francisco Foundation. In 2009, she had an artist residency at Central Track in Dallas, and in 2011, she was artist in residence at Women and Their Works in Austin. Lauren has been recognized for her hybrid media projects that engage history as a lens by which to view the sociopolitics of the present, challenging the tradition of documentary ethnography as objective by creating ethnofictive documents. She also explores how traditional monument making can be translated into contemporary models of commemoration, as seen with Drinking Fountain Number 1, a new media monument to the American Civil Rights Movement at Dallas County Records Building in Dallas. I think many of you are familiar with that project. It is a part of a larger public work Drinking Fountain project. And last year, Lauren's solo exhibition at the Chulong Gallery in Dallas, a gallery that presents work that acknowledges and engages with the prevalence of technology in the everyday, was a continuation of her exploration of subject and object with multi-channel video, sound interventions, as well as traditional works, some of which perhaps we will see tonight as Lauren shares the work and ideas that inform her practice and ongoing endeavor. So would you please join me in welcoming Lauren Woods.
Thank you, Terry, for the invitation to speak tonight, and all of the artists, culture workers, producers at The Modern. It's been great working here since the summer, various programs with you guys. And thank you all for coming out tonight. The line. So, I've been pondering one question this entire year. As an artist, a mother, a woman, American, and Black, the question I've been pondering is, can I really, and I mean really, afford to continue giving a fuck? And by giving a fuck, do I really mean not giving a fuck? Since the two phrases in the recent years have come to be the same thing, I'm not really sure how I should articulate this place I've been in for the past year, but I do know that it is certifiably an extended existential crisis that has thrown my entire identity as a professional practitioner into question. An artist having an existential crisis, right? Okay. Surprise. Yes, I'm used to the cyclical and often needed recentering, where I periodically check in to not only ask the question, but to affirm to myself just why it is that I have chosen the path of being an artist. The big question of why always produces some amount of angst. But never in a decade plus of practicing, when asked the question, have I met myself with such profound silence. There are no crickets, just what can be likened to vacuum chamber silence. It's deep and deafening silence. I know I was asked here tonight to give a talk about my work, and it would be much easier, I'm sure, for me to run through slides detailing a chronology of my practice. But I feel compelled, for whatever reasons, today, tonight, to be present as much as possible with you. So to be here honestly, because we actually don't talk that often in a formal setting about the invisible work of a cultural producer, the mental and emotional work that we do every day to keep ourselves and keep each other in this. We often talk about the results of a process, a product. Maybe we share the profound insights we often obtain from a particular line of inquiry or experimentation, but even yet and still, that's a product. We all walk this line in a context that often tells us that we shouldn't for a variety of reasons. When I contemplate how I arrived at this place of choosing the life of a cultural worker, and more specifically a visual artist, I could say it is most definitely because I got distracted from my initial plan to attend grad school, for which I was wanting to go for teaching and to remain in academia. I have always been a creative, however, no one who knew me, including myself, could have guessed that visual art would be where I landed. I mean, in my whole academic career, from preschool on, and I'm saying from preschool on, the first and only detention I ever had was an art class in the fifth grade. And my first and only grade in my whole academic career, from preschool until now, that was below a B, was an F in art school. In undergrad, I studied film, and I was always urged to go to the art department by my professors because I just wouldn't conform to the exercises and assignments precisely. But my response to that suggestion was always, what the hell am I going to do with an art degree? And yet, still, here I am with an art degree. Somehow I've become wonderfully distracted by this world of making and sharing ideas with the larger public. As James Baldwin so eloquently states, it is the past that makes the present coherent. And so in the incoherence of this past year, as I wait for the silence to be no more, it is my own past that I have been looking to for answers. I am obsessed with history, the archive, preservation, and how the larger concept of history relates to issues of power and social control. Beginning at a very young age, I've always been fascinated with history. My first recollections of engaging history were through the original PBS broadcast of the epic Eyes on the Prize series in the mid-80s. It was there in the comfort of my mother's lap that I first learned about the moment called the Civil Rights Movement. It was a moment that really marked my identity. I still have such a vivid memory of that moment of interaction with public television and history. Not completely understanding, but finally, I had a context for the scar that still remains, even to this day on my mother's right hand. As a young child, that scar was an anomaly that I strangely appropriated as comfort. I would hold her hand and run my fingers along the scar, and it was soothing to me. Like most parents, my mother eventually was faced with having to figure out how to explain things that were not so simple to a child who just wanted her simple curiosity satisfied. And like most parents, my mother tried to explain things as truthfully as possible, according to my sister and me and my sister's level of understanding at any given moment. The question of the scar in those early days would go, "Mommy, what happened here?" And she would say, "A man was very mean to me a long time ago." "Why?" "He grabbed my hand and scratched me." "But why?" "He did not want to let me get on the bus before him." "But why?" "Well, honey, a long, long time ago, some who have different skin color than you or me believed that anyone who didn't have white skin had to stand in this line second all of the time. And to kindergarten, standing in line second is like the worst thing ever." So I was like, okay. As a parent myself now, I've come to understand what that, "oh, okay," means. When my son Benjamin says it after a long series of "but whys," it usually means that he senses my difficulty with a particular explanation or is just flat out bored with his somewhat torturous game of "why." When he says, "oh, okay," he's letting me off the hook for now. When it is clear to me that he truly understands something, he says, "so," and then he repeats back to me whatever his epiphany is at the moment. And so my son, who is like me in so many ways, functions as a magical looking glass that reflects my past childhood from outside of myself. And so I can only imagine that my "oh, okay," after the many times I butt-wide my mother in her attempts to explain the scar, was most likely a way of showing mercy to her for having to explain an ugly reality that she was not quite ready for her daughter to be aware of just yet. But week by week of watching the visual tapestry of that of Eyes on the Prize, I began to intuitively understand how my mother's scar came to be. Even if I did not have the complete capacity to fully absorb why another human being would be so horrible to another and how systems of power were built on these acts of meanness, what I saw was that it was people like my mother and my father, my grandmother and grandfathers, aunts and uncles that were on the receiving end of this atrocious behavior. And somehow I managed, despite the spectacle of violence, to take away something more powerful. I saw resistance and strength, perseverance, triumphant dignity. Etched into my being at such a young age was this idea of a beautiful struggle. Into my adult years, creative expression was the mechanism that I could process and release history. It was also a way I could immediately respond to socio-political issues in my present moment. It was not enough to just absorb and archive data and research, and having activist parents wouldn't allow me to do that. Creatives have a strong desire to make or create a future because that is what the imagination is. A potential future. Manifesting what is in one's imagination is the act of making present that which was the future yesterday. In other words, it's like constructing a history. Creative production, particularly working in the audiovisual realms, gave me the ability to remix what I was learning about the world. I could layer it and create connections that span time and space, all in the moment of the present, thereby producing a text. In recent years, my studio practice has been less tied to the video medium itself and more conceptually based. I still pull from my native visual language, which is of the moving image and construction of cinema. I have always considered cinema to be a public art form in its own right that can also create and function as public memory. So sometimes dangerously. The desire to practice publicly and to address larger social issues came from socio-political leanings that were a natural byproduct of having activist parents. The first time I stepped out of the studio was out of a deep need to reconcile my politics with my developing practice. Museums are great for preserving and archiving culture and the project of humanity for posterity, and they're great meditation spaces. Galleries function in the same way, with adding an extra layer of inserting the product of the labor of artists into the marketplace. I personally needed to feel like my multiple interests and aspects of my constructed self were not so compartmentalized. I wanted the product of my labor to live and breathe, to respond and grow in context in which the work was created and inspired from in the first place. One of the major questions that came up from embarking on a public and socially engaged practice was that I needed to get clear with the ever-present question of why. Why was I choosing an intentional public practice in addition to my studio practice, and making the distinction of doing something for a particular public versus making an offering to the public? I found it dangerous when cultural practitioners and organizers interested in community-based practices proceeded with the idea that they were doing something for the community. This is a common phrase, it's for the community, which usually means it's engaging a blank and you can fill in whatever ethnic group you want to community, usually Black or Latino in the United States. Through the act of practicing publicly, I began to realize the implicit and false ideas of the monolith community that we use when we say the word community that are usually constructed to justify work or explain a project to a funder, that really, more than anyone else, because of their relationship to structural power, needs to understand the reality of multiple communities existing in any given moment in a defined region. Also needed to be understood was that individuals themselves are part of multiple communities. The idea of doing something for the community also created questions of whether the community wanted what I was creating or whether they even needed it at all. Setting up a framework of doing something for the public also set up the potential to become severely disappointed or disillusioned if an audience does not respond in a way that it was anticipated. So if I ask myself, how did I get here? How I have come to be a Dallas-based artist, it is clear that the answer lies in these early lessons learned from each gesture that I offered to the public that oriented my steps towards here. 6 years ago, I moved back to Texas from San Francisco as an artist in residence at Central Track in downtown Dallas to work to complete Drinking Fountain Number 1 and launch a Dallas Drinking Fountain project. This project consists of a new media public monument and other public social interventions that I began working on in 2005. 6 years ago, I moved to Dallas as an artist in residence and a soon-to-be mother, as I was 7 months pregnant at the time. I made an intentional choice to begin this journey of motherhood without the ideal structure, supportive partnership, heteronormative or otherwise. And this also deeply influenced my practice. Early revelations of motherhood compelled intentional commitment to public process as project, as a means to continue the work in the midst of exhaustion and domestic responsibility. I had to accept inherent vulnerability in allowing the public to bear witness to creative, professional, and personal growth. Single parenthood and commitment to my artistic practice meant subverting my ego, scheduling meetings despite the fear of perceptions of unprofessionalism. When my newly mobile infant, who was also in attendance, enthusiastically attempted to crawl out of conference rooms full of county administrators, or more often, managing to swiftly stick his hand down my shirt to help himself to the buffet that was breastfeeding life. This project, as a public process spanning years, a decade of pre-production, to be precise, mirrored the transitions of life and meant that just as county employees have witnessed Benjamin's growth and first steps, they witnessed mine as well, and all of the falling down necessary to gaining a new ability. So a lot of growth in the last 10 years, most rapidly in the last 5, and that should be all good, right? So why this crisis? Well, 2015 kicked off with one of the best highs of being a working artist. I opened my solo show at Chulon Gallery in Dallas, and this was my first solo exhibition in North Texas and the first one in a period of 4 years after deciding to forego my studio practice to intensely focus on my public one to launch Drinking Fountain Project. It was an incredible and truly humbling moment to have such great support and feedback for this show. It also made clear to me, if I hadn't already had my eyes open to it before, the uniqueness of our regional artistic community and the individuals that comprise it. I realized that a pervading sentiment of our community is that we are genuinely believers in the power of art. That cloud that I rode from the opening of the exhibition literally and unexpectedly thunderclapped my ass back to the ground in a torrential storm that I'm still wading through. The Monday following the Saturday artist reception for the show, I received a letter from the funders of a new public project I had spent all of 2014 working on, basically giving my life to the expense of my health and my personal life along with a collaborator. It was a show of power, a flexing and an attempt to censor the project before its public launch, which was to be this past summer. My collaborator and I have since been propelled into a literal David and Goliath battle in a way we've never anticipated or expected or experienced in our practices. So it's a huge learning curve. So yeah, of course this collision of socio-political public art and private interest was a catalyst for my crisis, but I found it was not the root of it. The root of my year of existential angst comes from the realization that tension compels me to be a cultural worker, and that while I was most likely a masochist in my 20s that found pleasure from this pain, I'm now exhausted by it. I'm questioning the idea of this beautiful struggle that was planted in me so long ago. Sure, a dispute over art is not the worst thing to be involved in, but when your entire identity is so closely tied to the why you do it, and you see it as part of a larger struggle in a continuum that you're a part of due to ancestry, I feel like I cannot not address seemingly trifling inequities that usually accumulate into a larger problem. My practice inherently seeks out the spaces to contribute to social transformation and to fill in gaps where the cracks don't serve us as a whole, but it sacrifices my body in the process of this larger esoteric ideal. I know intuitively that my journey thus far has not been by accident, that my time to float was not in vain, but I do feel an urgent need to be more intentional about my choice to continue on. I cannot any longer afford to feel perpetually destabilized and ungrounded by the two lives I lead, that I feel like I lead. Even if the grounds do perpetually shift, I know that if I'm to continue, I need to take time to respond to my own internal built environment, deconstruct it, figure out what's truly me, and rebuild to be able to travel lighter. So maybe tomorrow, I'll go back to that line. And as Carl Andre says in his artist statement in 1970 in Art Forum, he says, "The line is the first and also the very last thing, not only in painting, but also more generally in every construction. The line is passage, movement, collision, boundary, support, link, and division." And I literally have a dot, 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 because that's all I have for right now. I've been writing this in process. So I think the video's ended. So I did actually put some work on this PowerPoint. We can go through it a little bit. So the last 6 years, beginning in 2009, I actually took out a slide. I saved you guys from a birth picture of my son. Wasn't ready for that quite yet. This was 2010. And I'm just going to let the slides run for a little bit. Lights down? Oh, okay. Yeah, they can go down a little bit. The lights can go down just a little bit. This work is called A Portrait of an African Shore. I began it in 2010, and it's an ongoing archive of images from over 100 Hollywood and documentary. Any film that I see that claims to image the African shore, I rip it and keep it in an archive and add it to this. So this is a 5-channel synced monitor installation that evolves every 2 years. I update it. Right now, like I said, there's about 100 clips in it. This piece is called As Long as Earth and Sky Last. It's a commissioned billboard that lived in LA for a period of time at the intersection of Fairfax and Melrose Place. And it reads, "As long as Earth and Sky Last, smile like a flower in the garden of the world." It's an Urdu couplet by Vali Dakhani. And so now we get to 2013. This is the year that I launched Dallas Drinking Fountain Project. Here is the original court order that allowed
the air conditioner on campus broke. A problem was fixed, and classes will resume as usual tomorrow.
2 years ago, Dallas County commissioners were wrapped up in a controversy over what to do with the whites only signs that were once placed over water fountains in the records building. Well, that issue, it's come up again because an artist wants to do an historic artistic display at one of the fountains. New at 4, NBC 5's Ramona Logan is live in Dallas with the details on the story. The controversy continues.
Yes, the first one ended 2 years ago, as you said, when the county decided to put a plaque above the remnants of that white-only sign explaining the historic significance of the sign. An artist wants to take it one step further. Lauren Butterfly Woods wants to project a 45-second video on the wall over the remnants of a controversial whites-only sign over a water fountain.
As soon as the water coming on and projection would come on somewhere around this area.
The video would include historic images of civil rights protesters being pounded by water as they fought for the right to do simple things like drinking out of a public water fountain.
People being sprayed and, you know, pushed to the ground with these water hoses. And it's recontextualized and digitized and kind of played with. And I kind of retell the story of that era.
Agree to put it on the agenda.
I'm going to take a recess.
Woods remembers the controversy 2 years ago when protesters wanted the sign covered up.
For the newer generation, something like this is a living piece of history, and in a museum it can act as a tombstone, which can create a sort of apathy and distance.
Dallas County commissioners are interested in her concept. She's willing to produce it at no cost to the county. There is one hitch. Her original concept would not allow someone to drink from the fountain until the 45-second video plays out.
If somebody is interested and wants to be able to look at the history of it, then that's fine. But to force people to wait 45 seconds to get a drink, you basically make that water fountain inoperable.
I think it's okay to wait 45 seconds for a drink of water. Some of us have waited 45 years and longer for this day.
Now, I talked with SCLC President Joyce Foreman. She and others protested the whites only sign 2 years ago. She doesn't think the artistic video is a good idea. She believes that the white only signs and the video belong in a museum. Reporting live from Mona Logan, NBC5, Dallas.
Dallas. Yes, they were very careful to try to describe it as an artistic video.
We're going to unveil it, but we're not exactly
sure. So this
was
8 years later.
Because Jim Crow has come to haunt this building and created some, you know, technical things. So sometimes it's work, but by Monday, it will be all within concept. It's officially a sculpture.
The highlight of this project is Drinking Fountain Number 1, which is a new media interventionist monument where we transform the water fountain to dialogue with the relic that is in place. We're not commemorating white only, we're not commemorating Jim Crow or that time period, but we have this opportunity to look at the past to inform us of our future and to look to the past for inspiration.
Next to all.
So that was a drinking fountain. That was the unveiling of Drinking Fountain Number 1. And I continue with this work as I move into trying to create public programming in this space. So here's the space. You can kind of see the white-only trace highlighted. Some more pictures from the unveiling. And why that previous picture was pretty significant was because that was former commissioner, I'm forgetting my name now, but he was Republican, and then John Riley Price. Together, they were the two that, like, rallied the two factions to be able to approve the project. Senator Jackson, because he's a senator right now, Senator Jackson and Commissioner Price. This was 2014, and some early experiments with creating public programming at the space. 2014 was also, as I said, when at the end of the year was able to open the solo exhibition at Chulong Gallery. And so here's some slides from that exhibition. So that is how that original footage, which was from the Birmingham campaign, ended up in a work. This is called Looking Down on My Soul Now. What was exciting about working at Chulong on this show was I got to work with the concept that I had been throwing around for a while, which is the concept of the red carpet. We were able to install 2,500 square feet. Does that sound familiar? Anybody? Asia? Yeah, okay. 2,500 square feet of red carpet into the gallery. And it was a project that I had actually proposed to do in Orange County for the California Biennial, but they didn't have the budget to be able to do it. So I got to try it out here in Dallas at Chulong. So it's actually one of my current obsessions now to work sculpturally with red carpet and figured out how to work into more of my work. This piece is called Baghdad by the Bay. Tempest Tossed. And Portrait Number 1. This piece is so new that I couldn't even put the slide on it because I just put it on here. This piece is called a Conversation Number 1, Haints Blues in the Parenthetical. It's a collaboration that I did just a few weeks ago with Stephen Lapthisopon in the West Dallas neighborhood, West Dallas, where Trinity Groves is. Oops, technical.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm back. I was like, it's weird being dressed in front of people. Okay, so how much time do we have?
We have
only 8 o'clock. Okay, so we can do any questions or anything.
Lauren.
Yes.
Hey, back here.
Yes. Hey.
First of all, your work is brilliant. You are brilliant. I just want to say that. And also, I'm empathetic to the fatigue of utopian idealism, and I'm not sure how to deal with it, so we'll have to talk. But I didn't know that performance was so central to your new media practice. What's the relationship between performance and the live act and the kind of recorded image, if there is any?
Yeah, I think it's something, so I played with it early on, but I was like, I'm not using my body. It was like one work that I use my body in. But I think that something became clear to me, and I think it coincided with having a child and not caring about how my body performs anymore publicly, not being really self-conscious about it. And then also realizing that even in my public social, my practice and publicly, my body is still sort of a performative object that gets projected on, and all the multiple roles that I take to produce a work is a performance in itself. And so I didn't really think about it until after the fountain unveiled. And the woman who worked on as the project manager was like, oh my God, I didn't realize you were such a great performer. And I was like, I wasn't performing. And she's like, yes, but you were. To see this trajectory of 24 hours where you were to that moment, everybody was biting their lips because we knew about all the glitches and we didn't know how you were going to handle it. And so I think that I'm slowly becoming more aware and comfortable with being able to intentionally work with my body in that way.
It works.
Thank you. Tonight is actually my first live performance. Starting to sting.
Can you talk a little bit about what just happened and why? And
The concept for this tattoo sort of came in one of my pre-crisis moments about 3 years ago, and probably a little bit after Benjamin was born, when I realized, you're not a homeowner, you're not responsible, how are you going to, make a growth tree that he can see forever, you know? And it just became clear, if it wasn't going to be, architecture, a specific house that we would, put these memories on, then it had to be my body. But I've never had a tattoo, and I've never been able to commit to a tattoo, even though I love body art. So this was something that I was like, okay, let me think about this. And then I met Patrick just a few months ago, and it became clear this was the moment now to do it. He helped me to come up with, or to make it concrete, what the concept would be, which is a straight line from my ankle up to my middle fingertip. And when it's resting, it looks curved, but once it snaps up, it's a complete straight line. It doesn't move with my body or anything. So it's something that year after year, I will measure Benjamin's growth and keep it with me. And I've also kept his since he was a baby and able to pull up on me, I kept those measurements as well because I wanted to always remember where his hands were on my body at any given moment as a way of remembering where he was in growing process. So we'll put those hash marks on as well.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, since nobody's talking. it makes me think of Femme Maison, the series by Louise Bourgeois, those drawings that she did in the late 40s, just dwelling where we ontologically dwell.
Mm-hmm. So I called a friend actually at 2 o'clock in the morning in Seattle, and he mentioned her as well when I was telling him what I was planning on doing. He actually talked me down. He was like, so in the existential crisis, of course I'm reading, about existentialism and making it worse. And so I really, for whatever reasons, between black existentialism and everything else and feminism, whatever, I still came back to Sartre, and I was telling him that, and he was like, why would you as a black woman talk about Sartre? And he's like French, you know, and he's just like, you know, he totally like talked me down and made me be like, okay, I guess I'm not going to talk about it, you know. But that's where I sort of keep coming back to. And particularly there's a film transcript, Sartre by himself. And I've seen the film, but I haven't been able to watch it because it's in French. And then the only copy that I have access to has Portuguese subtitles. So it's like complete, like utter, like no translation at all. But I have the transcript, and so I've read it. And so he really talks, the passages that I would keep coming back to was when he talked about the construction of the intellectual and how it's like a baby of the bourgeois, you know. But at the same time, like we want to stay in the unhappy conscious state because it allows us to like buck against the very, you know, pet that, you know, the how we are a pet of the bourgeois, but we like can buck against it. And that's how I kind of feel trying to manage the multiple like roles I have between like a studio and a public practice to get these things done. And I'm also, you know, I grew up middle class, so I come from that, you know, I don't come from the same sort of lineage in terms of, I feel very much like between two worlds, you know? And so, and I think that's also why I never would have imagined I would have landed in visual arts because of the like hierarchy. It seems like it's the farthest away from the people, which I've grown up to, you know, not be far away from, at least in theory. Yes?
So in your last piece, it made me think of the work of Carl Pope, who did a video at the Whitney Biennial in 2000. And if you look at the arc of his work, he couldn't continue to do that. The work of, you know, he had himself tattooed with the words of a sister. It was really meant to be a work about, it was really sort of, that moment of the Whitney Biennial.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for him as an artist who wanted to engage with the public sphere, if he had to choose between words and the body, the two things that made up that work, he chose words. And so you look at a lot of his work today, and it's posters. He works with the community to engage it. So I find it interesting that you started your presentation with work that engaged with the public, but you ended with a work on your body, which mm-hmm. is really private about you and your relationship with your son and body and touch. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that private public and the sight of the body in that. It's not, the body doesn't have to always be private, but I think Carl felt very conflicted about the body in a public space and who gets to claim that body and that body in violence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. That's a lot. It's everything. So the body in public space and how it relates, how in terms of my practice, like in my body. I mean, that's the weird thing for me is that I never intentionally engaged my own body, even though I didn't realize how much of a player it is in all my work. And especially in the invisible, like, things surrounding a work. But I always tended to think that whatever I created was, like, somehow my, like, surrogate body, right? And I tended to think that also, even though my work is usually situated in some sort of, like, identity politics or construction of blackness, like, really my work is actually looking at whiteness because there's no, you know, the construction of blackness is hand-in-hand with whiteness, right? And so I haven't previously before, like, really considered my body that way. But working publicly and in a way that my body isn't intentionally there, but I am, like, a player. Like, in the Drinking Fountain Project, when I'm there in the space, and I consider myself, like, an artist in residence at the county building, like, I activate that space. And I'm very much aware that, like, my body activates it. And everything that my body, my cultural representation, everything that you can read from it. And so I think right now where I am is trying to get, like, really intentional about that, if that sort of answers it a little bit. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm curious about what's the cause of your crisis.
I know. I know. I talked around it.
Or what would make it better?
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, so this is actually a thing that I know. So I talked way around things. So when I launched the Drinking Fountain Project, the Nasher
Sculpture Center did a dinner talk to talk about the work. And actually, what I wanted to get to, and I think this was probably like a prelude to my crisis maybe, was wanting to have like a transparent conversation about the things that we tell ourselves, which I think sometimes is riddled with delusion in order to keep ourselves going, right? And so for me, like, I don't want to keep telling myself that, like, art will save the world or it, you know, reminds us of our humanity. Like, those are all beautiful things to contemplate, but it's not feeding me in the same way anymore. Like, I feel like I need something more concrete. And so the crisis this year literally started because it was a sort of realization that how cultural workers are treated in the larger, like, society, in terms of like, it's all really cute and fun until you assert sort of power, your own power or your own knowledge, right? So I've literally had conversations where like, I'm like, oh, we should place like wording over here. And like, someone with no like background in design or arts be like, I've been to the Louvre and seen the Mona Lisa, you know, like, it shouldn't go there. And I'm like, what did I just spend the last 10 years of my life doing? Like, it's still not enough, you know? It's still not enough to be like, I have a degree, or I studied this, or I research it, you know? It's like, at some point, I've always, like, kind of butted up against this moment where it's like, the trust is not there for an arts worker in the larger public, when you're working in the larger public. And so, with this sort of beginning of this year, sort of dedicating, you know, a significant amount of time to a project and like being a surrogate mother with it with my collaborator, it literally felt like having a baby like taken away from me before I even like gave birth to it, and not being able to like reason and not having like a lawyer or, you know, big guns behind me to like talk in the same language. And so, yeah, it's just thrown me into this space of like, like, you want to feel like it really is important what you're doing, and you want to like start to feel respected in that as well. Okay, I'm rambling. But yes. Mm-hmm.
So you're obviously working in a public process, yeah. A public art process where the term public means a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just curious about, will you continue to work in that kind of realm? Do you find hope for it? Do you think it's just making art by committee, or
yeah.
What's the best case scenario for artists in that situation?
I think for me, so I think like going back to studio practice was sort of like my licking my wounds and like getting my energy back. But I don't think I can stay away from a public practice for too long. I already have like 10 million ideas. But I think the key for me, at least, is being intentional about how I choose my partnerships, right? Before this process, if anyone asked me to say do something, I'd be like, yes, let's do it. And I really wouldn't look at the intentions of the people who I was working with to understand like what their learning curve would need to be able to work in the direction I want to work with. So for me, what was really special about the Drinking Fountain project was that I really do feel like it's a people's monument. It was all funded by, you know, national foundations and wasn't any private or family or anything like that. In fact, I solicited and never got a response. I did get responses, but they were negatives because of the content of the work or not understanding, is this history, is this art, is this blah, blah, blah. So mostly national funders, but then the last chunk of the money did come from the county, and which is a people's fund, tax dollars. And when we unveiled the project, there were like 200 people there, and the county's like never had like that for like such a like small thing. Like, that's not a bridge, you know? So I really do feel like this was a model of like working publicly, which is for me, like, because I didn't have like an art commission to go to, and I started this project when I lived in San Francisco, I really had to learn that entire process step by step that artists are usually shielded from. And I got to make the like decisions that would help me like align all of like the conceptual aspects with like the sort of sociopolitical strategies I was trying to push through as well with the work. So yeah, in the future, it's just going to be a matter of like me being able to choose my partnership and actually stand in my agency for the projects that I work on. and have a lawyer on hand before. Anybody else?
Yes,
in the back.
What's the significance of the red carpet?
The red carpet. So the piece that was in the Too Long show was called A Trample Upon These Tinted Splendors. And I originally started that work, and like I said, in 2008, the California Biennial wanted me to do an intervention at the site of the museum, which is the Orange County Art Museum in Newport Beach. So if you know, like, Orange County, Housewives, whatever, like, you know the context of where this museum is. So every time I went for a site visit, it was always closed off to the public because there was, like, a red carpet event. And I was like, huh, this is interesting. Like, this particular space is, like, literally, like, a backdrop just for, like, this lifestyle, you know? Like, I wonder if, like, the art's even being engaged with. So the piece that I proposed to Orange County for the California Biennial was to just red carpet everything. I was like, we're red carpeting the parking lot, the, like, sidewalk, up to the, like, the facade, and then I had, like, model was to go around the inside, so kind of like you're walking into like a red vagina or something. It would just like keep going and just be an overgrowth of red carpet because, hey, they liked red carpet. And so the curator like was like, I love this. And then it was just like, I can't do this. It's like too much money. And it's like, you know, just a lot of like prep for this one piece. So I never got to do it until studio visit with Asia Martin, who's the director at Too Long, saw it in my my unrealized, like I have a million unrealized projects. And she's like, what's this? And I'm like, oh, it's this red carpet thing. And she's like, can we do it in the gallery? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, can we? She's like, let's do it. And so we did it. And it was really great to be able to start to work with that material and create sort of. So the carpet looked like a regular red carpet as you were walking in. But then when you went inside the gallery, it flooded out into the space. And as you walked toward the back of the space, the vantage point grew smaller to like till it was like an inch wide. So as you walked, it went from like, I don't know, 30 feet or something to like an inch wide. And it was really interesting how that kind of tied all of these video works because there were like 12 video pieces from over the course of 5 years in the space. And it really did create this nice like link between all of it. And I think it talks about like a current like obsession with celebrity and how art functions around that. And the red carpet is like a certain amount of like Americanness for me, even though the title of the work is like from a Greek tragedy. But yeah. Mm-hmm.
The work that got stilted or stunted by the official letter, can you speak about how that's transformed or where it may show up again? Or can you speak about it?
I can't speak about it. I wish I could. But it will. It will. It will not die. It will not die. And, you know, I do want to say, I think my collaborator's here. Yeah, Cynthia. Cynthia Mulcahy has been my collaborator for the past year, and actually we met. She came to the Drinking Fountain unveiling. That was the first time we met, and then we ended up working together, like literally, like I'm like her second spouse for the past year together. And we've just so the project is actually looking at Dallas's historically segregated parks and constructing a people's history of historic Black communities through these parks. And it's been amazing with the things that we found digging. And it really, for us, in our mind, there's sort of lost history that Dallas needs to like unearth. And it just such a rich political and active history in the early 1900s that we tend not to think about because we just like hold our hand in shame, our head in shame because like Martin Luther King was like banned or something. But we had this like here in Dallas, but we had this like really rich activist history in the early part of the 20th century. And we've been able to find, like, you know, first-hand documents, images from, we've gone door-to-door communities, organizing events to get people to bring their personal archives. So we found, like, gorgeous photos that don't live in any official archive. So we're really committed to seeing this this project through, and we just have to figure out how we're going to see it through. Anybody else?
Lauren, could you just maybe end by talking a little bit about why you chose tonight to get a tattoo, and you know Anne's point about the notion of it being this private, kind of the most private thing, but you decided to do it in this public venue, and what those decisions were?
You know, it. So as I was like preparing for the talk, part of why my text probably wound everywhere is I did feel like something I physically needed to mark this particular moment. For me, November and December have come to be like rebirthing, transformational moments. Am I talking right into it? Okay. I launched Drinking Fountain Project in November, and then exactly a month later, my son turned 5 years old. And so for me, these 2 months have now become very significant. And being able to speak in this space as part, like at the end of this year of angst, is very meaningful for me as well, to have like a museum talk and have the sort of freedom to sort of have this cathartic experience. So it wasn't enough just to show the video. I wanted to share, for me, to mark this body, this moment as well, for me, what it means to me.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.